Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Gruesome movies. Today, The Snowman. No, not that one. Michael Fassbender tackling a cold case in Thomas Alfredson's slice of Nordic noir. Will we give it a frosty reception? Then, Noah Baumbach returns with The Merit Stories, brackets new and selected, parents parking and parentheses, and how difficult it is to get them right. There's more Baumbach too in the film club, Noah and the Squid and the Whale. By Ambassador, with these navel-gazing New York nods to resolving your father issues via the medium of film, you're spoiling us. All of that plus more Blade Runner 2049, it's Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. And on board your very own Truth and Movies today, we have Manuela Lazic.
Hello.
Hi, Manuela. And also David Jenkins, who's got a cold again.
Sorry.
That's all right. I'm sorry for you, David.
I'll try and keep up.
If I'm a bit slow today,
then I apologise.
Right.
I think it's important to mention that David brought his box of Kleenex from his office.
Right.
Carrying it on the streets.
I've had it all morning with me, like a kind of little chihuahua.
Exactly.
A tissue chihuahua.
I hope the many cinematic splendours at the London Film Festival currently ongoing have been some sucker to you this week.
Oh, they certainly have. Especially the one at the film I saw this morning.
What was that?
Which is called Zarma.
Oh, yeah.
Lucretia Martel, which is a film that I've wanted to see for ages and ages and ages. I think it's coming out in the new year. It's a really weird Argentinian experimental movie, I guess you'd call it.
It's quite experimental, yeah.
But
well, Manuela, you were flagging this up last time you were in as one of the ones to watch, I think.
Oh, was I? Oh, yeah.
Were you not?
I don't remember, but I definitely told Jenks when I saw it in Toronto, I messaged him, I was like, you will like Zarma. And he said... FML. So, yeah, I was right.
You were right. How's your week been, Manuela?
It's been all right, except for, obviously, the Harvey Weinstein situation. Mm. So, obviously, you know, this is not a podcast where we have the space and the knowledge to talk in depth about this. But I think it's important to mention that, you know, as film lovers, we are obviously really angry and devastated. And at the same time, myself, I'm quite... somehow optimistic that, you know, we are now in a climate where women feel able to come forward. So, yeah, that's all we can really say here. But, yeah, this is something we have to acknowledge.
It's a negative story, but in the fact that it's actually come out is deeply positive.
Yeah. I just think we have to see what happens next.
Absolutely.
I remember I saw someone saying that it feels like a kind of tip of the iceberg thing that there's maybe,
yeah,
there's,
totally.
You know, how it might be a kind of bigger things to come.
Yeah.
But
we can't be naive about it, but yeah, but it's a step in the right direction.
Mm. But it feels like one of the biggest sort of film industry scandals.
Yeah,
like,
that I've known
for a long time.
I mean,
it feels big, but yeah, as you say, like too big, maybe
too big for this tiny podcast.
For a little old Truth and Movies. If you'd like to be involved in enlarging Truth and Movies with your comments, do send them in. You can email them. The address is truthandmovies@tcolondon.com. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter @LWLies. And, of course, there is now the splendid new message board on the littlewhitelies.com website. Chris Gape says, I really wanted to add to the Darren Aronofsky discussion a while ago. I hoped you were going to talk about his film Pi, my favourite of his. I've always thought of Aronofsky, I'm subbing this down a bit, as a concept filmmaker, a little bit like making a concept album. Sometimes it works and opens ideas and provokes thoughts. Other times it feels a bit pretentious and obvious. Did we ever get your views on Mother! Exclamation mark, Manuela.
I do not think so, but I would love to give them.
Go on, a two-sentence review.
I think it's one of the worst movies I've seen in a long, long time.
Really?
And... it's so insanely stupid. And it's amazing to see a filmmaker managing to make a movie where the main character is a woman about him. So, yeah.
That's a really interesting point. I think it's really brave in the way it embraces stupidity. And I think it does make a point with that.
I wish it were more fun with its stupidity, but it's not fun enough.
There's quite a lot of fun in there, I thought. But hey, interesting. Okay, so you were a bit mixed and I really liked it. Is that right, David?
Yeah.
Whether to go and see Mother?
I think we probably, as a threesome, represent the entire spectrum of opinion on the film Mother.
That's
because it's across the board from love to hate.
Paul Underwood wanted to pick up that conversation we were having about the use of music or the non-use of music in movies and the relative power of the two respective methods. He puts forward The Birds, you know, by Hitchcock, as a film completely devoid of a musical score, which manages to hold and create the tension so brilliantly. The silence is so much more powerful than any strings, etc., can provide. Nice shout, that, no?
No, good one.
Mm. And on our message board, John says, please revisit Blade Runner 2049 when you can explain your review better. I know you didn't want to talk about spoilers and stuff, but it feels like half a job. Well, you're in luck, John, because there's been loads of Blade Runner 2049 comment, a lot of it relating to David Jenkins' controversial views. Kevin Kassane, or Kassane, hello, Kevin, says, one intriguing yet baffling piece of feedback I've witnessed states that unlike 90-minute movies, this one at least offers value for money, that's something, isn't it?
Yeah, Westra? I guess so.
But Ian O'Riordan says he was so enraged by your comments on Blade Runner 2049 last time out that he's basically written a pretty excellent little essay. Let's go through some of his points. He says, I really like David, by the way, which is his kind of version of with all due respect at the start. Yeah. But I think he's so off on this in many strands. I would agree that the script is better in the original film than 2049, but he points out he's actually been and read the original book, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, by Philip K. Dick. And he says, having actually read it, have you read it, David?
No.
Okay.
Well, he
says,
talk about it.
He says that 2049 actually recaptures the mood and tone of Philip K. Dick's book much better than the original film. This tells him that Villeneuve took more inspiration from the novel than the prequel. He also takes exception to your dismissal of Villeneuve's female characters. Like I said, says Ian, I like David Jenkins, but I will fight any man any day who says there aren't enough strong female characters in this film. Have you had a chance to think again about that at all?
Do you want to fight?
I think, I mean, if a fight is what is needed, then, you know, time and place.
You were pretty absolute in your views.
Oh, yeah, no, I will not.
Willfully
I will
so,
not
I
budge,
think.
I will not budge an inch on that.
Do you know, but sometimes.
And I would say, I would say, I did read all his comments.
He's got more points afterwards, actually.
No, it was a really big
Gosling,
nice
he says, Gosling went full drive in this film. My God, did it work. Ford was blessed with an amazing script, but he never truly embodied Rick Deckard's coldness in the way that Gosling does. He also says, before we come back to your point, Dave Bautista was great. I really want to see more of him. Any suggestions? Obviously, Guardians of the Galaxy 1 and 2, which are brilliant. Hey, David?
did it pick up that sigh?
Okay, sorry. Back to what you were saying about female characters.
I have nothing more to say than I've already said. The one comment I will say about in response to that is, I think there's an interesting discussion for another day about literary adaptations, about the connections to source material, about the job of a filmmaker and a writer when it comes to actually transposing words on a page to images on the screen, and how much license you should take and how much it should be your own thing. And when I go and see a film, I don't think it's necessarily think it's the job of a film critic to have read a book as well.
No, absolutely not.
Reviewing a film that's been specifically made to be consumed in a completely different way.
So. Absolutely. But I think Ian makes a fair point when he says that when you're talking about the original tone of the book, that this is what Villeneuve has managed to recapture better than perhaps...
Does it make for a good film? That's what matters.
Well, I thought it did. I thought it did. I wonder whether this is one of those films, and it happens to us all, that something about the movie gets you back up and it makes everything about the film seem negative. Because while you do have some valid points, you're a little bit kind of fundamentalist in your rejection of pretty much everything about this film.
Fundamentalist.
No, I mean, I stand by everything I said.
All right.
You know, I didn't go into the film wanting to hate it, and every film I go and see, whether it's The Snowman or anything else, I'm looking for the good things. I'm looking for the positive stuff. Mm-hmm.
Right.
If we as critics were like, you know, if we wanted to hate every movie, where would we?
No, I don't think he wanted to, but I think it's just sometimes things catch you at the wrong time, on the wrong day, with the wrong person, whatever it is.
I was super excited to see it. You know, we were sat there beforehand we were talking.
Maybe
about
that was
it,
the problem.
I just
let me say, in the interest of balance, I liked it almost as much as you didn't. So, there you go. So, 2049.
I will say also that I love the fact that people love this film.
Good.
I'm merely offering a kind of counter.
It's not had a great time at the box office, though, has it, so far?
In the UK, it has.
Mm.
But in the US, I think it's underperformed. But you know what? It's that stupid thing of, like, you know, it's 2 days worth of box office. You know, it'll probably come out in, you know, elsewhere and make loads of money in China or Middle East or something. And, you know, all of a sudden it'll have been a big hit. And but because of that 1 day or 2 days, people have just like, oh, no, it's a flop. It's not a flop.
That's how they rate movies now these days. You know, like, there's no space for time. But at the same time, it's understandable because movies don't stay in theaters much longer. So it's complicated.
Okay. Let's talk about some of this week's movies before they're gone. Hey, Manuela.
Yeah.
All right, and first up for us, here's The Snowman. Here's a clip.
Layla Olsen and Arvis Stope are having an affair, and that's the last thing my father was investigating before he got killed.
You broke into Vetlesen's house because you were afraid I'd find out this was personal and take you off the case.
Vetlesen was his pimp. And they were both in Bergen when the murder started.
I know how much you want this, but you can't force the pieces to fit.
Do you actually think he killed them?
I don't know. I don't think either of us do for sure.
Maybe this will bring your balls back.
Michael Fassbender plays Danish detective Harry Hull, a brilliant but broken man who's trying to track down a serial killer with a penchant for snowmen against a backdrop of political intrigue and loads of billowing snow. Also involved in what's actually a really good week for all-star casts at the cinema are J.K. Simmons, Rebecca Ferguson, Chloe Sevigny and Charlotte Gainsbourg, and a truly bizarre appearance from Val Kilmer, who provides the answer at last to that question: what would Tim Nice But Dim of the Harry Enfield Show look like if he'd spent the last 20 years kind of in booze-addled Nordic sleuthing? Is that fair?
That's very fair, I think.
Okay.
And very vivid.
Right. The director, excitingly, is Thomas Alfredson, who did Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, the recent remake, but before that hit the headlines with Let the Right One In. This is lifted from a Joe Nesbo, or possibly Yo Nesbo, novel. And I met Thomas, actually, the director, last week, and he had this to say.
It's fascinating to talk to you, and I've just seen The Snowman, and because I knew I was speaking to you, I was thinking about how it links up with your other films. And the conditions in The Snowman, which are visually very muted because of the snow and the wind and the mist, and there's one tremendous shot, which I'm sure you must have been really happy with afterwards, when there's a frozen lake and there's kind of a mist trail, the way that the air is playing with the mist over the lake. It's an extraordinary shot.
Yeah.
Was that something that came about by chance or something that you'd actually gone for?
Both. You know, when this is shot in March and in a quite high elevated place on this lake, frozen lake, you'd have those phenomenons early in the morning when the sun goes up. You get those weird mist things. It looks like angels dancing over the ice, and that's something you'd see. But this particular one we had in the film was made midday, so it's created there, but it looks like it's a real one.
I got a bit sidetracked because the question I was going to ask was, in Sweden, where you're from, are the conditions extreme like that, or was that something that you particularly went to seek out? Because for an English audience, it makes it a little bit otherworldly. There's a mutedness to sound. There's almost, with the mist, with the clouds of snow, there's almost a separation from reality. Was that something that you were particularly seeking, or is that just how things are there?
That's how things are if you seek them up. We have similar landscapes in Sweden, but Norway is blessed with, you know, it's so spectacular and it's extra everything on everything there. So it's like a dream for a filmmaker to to work in Norway because of the landscapes are so spectacular.
Would your next production be somewhere sunnier?
Maybe.
Yeah, because I can imagine it was fairly challenging.
It is quite hard to work in low temperatures. You know, all the equipment and, you know, standing still for 10 hours in minus 15, it's quite demanding.
Right.
I have a ridiculous down overall thing, and it's bright yellow. So you look like a yellow sofa or something walking around. And the first day I came to the set with this, everyone was laughing at me. But at the end of the day, I was the one laughing.
Right. Everyone was in yellow sofas the next day.
Yeah.
Thomas Alfredson, who I have to say is a lovely man, whatever we might think about this movie.
Yeah.
Manuela, do you like this kind of film, this kind of Scando-noir thing?
I mean, as much as the next person, I don't know. I'm not big on them. I don't really read those books either. But I have to say, this did not make me want to read them. to get the story straight first. So Michael Fassbender is a detective, and he's, you know, classic detective style. He's, you know, a drunk, divorced, sad. He doesn't speak much. He wears always the same coat. And
like sleeping on the street as well, in sub-zero conditions.
Yeah, because he's so drunk, he doesn't even feel it.
Yeah.
So it's fine. And one day he receives a letter, a weird letter, and there's a little snowman drawn on it. Mm. And then basically some serial killing happens. And
exactly.
Yeah.
Snowman. Here's a question. Can snowmen, whose appearance in this film is meant to be the harbinger of awful events, can they ever be scary?
No, I mean, like, it's interesting what they do here, because, you know, the serial killers, because every serial killer has a trademark.
Right.
You know, every serial killer worth their salt. And, you know, this guy is the snowman.
Yeah. You have the Zodiac Killer, and then you have the snowman.
Mm.
So, yeah, Zodiac Killer had the cool kind of hieroglyphics, and this guy has, you know, he'll build a little snowman near the scene of the crime. And what they do is you'll see this horrific scene.
Yep.
And then one of the characters will kind of look around, and out of the corner of their eye, they'll see this kind of little snowman just innocently playing.
Its arms will be outstretched in a slightly menacing fashion.
Yeah. And there's a big kind of clash of, you know, Hitchcockian strings on the soundtrack. Like, this snowman's coming to get you. He'll penetrate your nightmares.
Or like a zoom in, or like a boom, all of a sudden a snowman. And I don't know, I think it's maybe a case of, like, you know, clowns are really scary, right? Clowns, it's easy to make clowns scary.
They can be.
But, like, often, like, it's easy to make a clown look scary. I think
apparently not, judging by it.
I think this movie had other problems.
Yeah.
But I don't think, like, to make a snowman scary, you have to try a bit harder than this.
How would you make a snowman? I mean, it's kind of the equivalent of leaving puppies behind. If you were a serial killer, leaving puppies or little rabbits or something. There's just no way,
rabbits
I don't think.
Rabbits would be really scary.
Do you think
that
so?
Yeah. Because
it's
rabbits
alive.
Would actually be a bit more random.
I feel we're getting off track here. Okay, so basically the
what
snow...
What would you do if you were a serial killer? What would you leave behind? That's the question. No.
I'm not sure I'm willing to enter that particular mindset, Manuela.
For legal
know.
Reasons.
It is a surprising film, this... not least because it's kind of lacking in any of that edginess that we had in Let the Right One In.
Yeah, exactly. It's not going far at all. I'm scared easily at movies, but I was not scared once.
Mm.
Like, I was, after a while, I understood that I would never see anything too scary. There's some beheadings and stuff, but it's shown in such a, you know, Hollywood not wanting to be disturbing way, so it's really boring. And but also what makes it not scary is that it's kind of hard to follow because the editing is so all over the place. About I think like 20 or 30 minutes in, all of a sudden you have a flashback and he says 9 years earlier and there's a new character and it's Val Kilmer and you're supposed to get anything out of this. And then as it goes on, you understand that he was a detective himself and all that, but it's just all over the place.
I have to say, and you guys might not agree with me with this, but like it's one of those, it's a whodunit. Mm-hmm. And if you can't guess whodunit within about, like, maybe the first time the person comes on screen.
Mm.
I didn't get it, but I wasn't even asking the question, which is a worrying sign. I was just going to say that this film, do you know when you're watching a film and within about 30 seconds you realise, no, this isn't going to happen? I know that's... that's wrong. What happened was, I'm sat there watching it, the opening sequence, the kind of the pre-titles flashback that sets up the whole emotional heart of the film, it just completely failed to convince me. And then when the titles ran and it had the cast, I went, oh yeah, I remember, this has got an exceptional cast, I was really looking forward to seeing this. I'm sure it's going to be good despite that, but it really wasn't. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a couple of, I mean, one really technical issue is the audio on it, the dialogue's all been looped, it's all been redubbed and really badly. It's a little bit watching, it's a little like watching one of those, what do you call them, Euro pudding productions when everyone's just come and dubbed the voiceover. That's not convincing. The casting is just bizarre. We mentioned Val Kilmer, but J.K. Simmons, how did that happen and why and what?
There are so many narrative strands that start and stop, and by the end of the movie, they're not resolved, and it doesn't feel like it was intentional. It feels like in the editing room they were trying to do something with it. And what's interesting also about the editing, I don't want to bang on about this, but on screen in the credits it says editing by one person, and then also Thelma Schoonmaker, Scorsese's longtime collaborator.
So she edited Goodfellas. She's got form.
Put some perspective there. Yeah. And it really feels like she tried her best with what she had, because that's why there's also so much overdubbing. Like, the first time Val Kilmer is on screen, his lips don't match what he's saying at all.
His lips don't match with his face as well, though. Did you notice that?
And there's lots of shots of him talking from behind as well. His performance is... From the camera is behind.
Oh, yeah.
But I think his performance does have kind of cult classic... potential, actually.
Oh, yeah. I can't wait for this to come out on DVD and go crazy.
I was... One of the things... I mean, I did, you know, it functions as a very bland kind of whodunit potboiler, and it's, you know, it just about delivers, I think, on those terms. And I was trying to think, is there anything good in this film? And the one thing that I could settle on was there were lots of good shots of cars driving over bridges.
It's a nice
really
bridge. It's quite a sinuous bridge,
The one thing I like that, but the one thing that I didn't like even in those shots was the weird CGI effect. Like, it looked very... everything looked really smoothed out. And sometimes the camera movements was just way too smooth and weird. And it really feels like they spent a lot of money on CGI.
It's true.
There was one at the end that had... It was a kind of very... weird angle to be shooting it at, and the bridge kind of curved, the perspective looked really weird.
Yeah,
I mean, that's
looks like a beautiful country.
Small, simple pleasures, I guess.
The landscape,
but
it
is a film that involves lots of people driving to other places to find clues. And I also thought one of the funny things, and I messaged you to remind me to say this.
Oh, yeah,
I mean, I don't even know if we should mention the brand, but there was one of the most bizarre pieces of product placement I've ever seen, I think.
Makes no
sense. For what?
It was basically, there's a sequence where Fassbender's character travels out to go and meet a guy at a factory, and he's sort of working on this factory floor, and he's wearing a big
headphones.
Set of headphones that are... you know, very, very popular amongst sort of LA teenagers.
Yeah.
And he's a kind of slightly older gent as well. It's...
And when he turns his head, the light hits exactly on the logo and you're like, this is so obvious.
And it's
out of place.
It just seems very weird that they would have chosen that character to be wearing the headphones when there is a young teenage son who actually wears headphones in other scenes.
Exactly.
Right.
Or when they're on computers researching things or whatever. Yeah. Any other character could have done this. Very odd.
I know that's...
Maybe they were Model Zone.
Simple pleasures.
They were what?
Model Zone, you know.
Oh.
Maybe they were. I don't know. Anyway, all right.
That's
The Snowman then. Yeah. And Emanuele, you go first. Anticipation, enjoyment during, thoughts post.
Sure. So anticipation, I would say maybe... Well, that's interesting because the posters... We have to mention the posters.
Why? What happened
the
on the posters?
The posters were the most hilarious posters I've seen in a long time. They looked like graffiti, but bad, and the words were so stupid. They sounded like Drake lyrics. I saw
that's
a tweet
stupid.
Saying that. Yeah, it was so funny.
What did the words say?
So the poster said, "Mr. Police, you could have saved her. I gave you all the clues. And it's drawn like the serial killer's notes, and there's a little snowman drawn, and then it says, the snowman. And it's so funny. And I, there's this tweet that people shared around that said, not sure about this new Drake album. It's so funny. So, yeah, and also the trailer where it's kind of exactly like the movie where you have Michael Fassbender looking like scared or like worried, and then cuts to snowman. So that kind of built my anticipation, but not as in I was expecting something good.
Right.
So I'd say 3. Okay. Anticipation out of 5.
Okay.
Enjoyment, I'd say 3.5 because it's really, really funny.
Oh, you did enjoy it, but yeah, not in the way that it was intended.
Not it was good, no.
Okay. And post?
So I think it's worth seeing. But and post, just 2. I mean,
okay.
I think it might become
a cult
classic.
I want to ask you, though, yeah. Interesting though those numbers are, do you have, as I do, a favorite movie tagline from poster? What is it?
It's the Point Break.
What is the Point Break one?
It goes 27 banks in 3 years, anything to catch the perfect wave. So if you don't know what the movie is about,
you do know.
It makes no sense.
Ah.
But if you know, it still makes very little sense because the movie makes no sense because it's insane.
What are you talking about?
Point Break.
That's such a girl thing to say, Manuela. It makes total sense.
I mean, it's a great, perfect film. I love it so much. Yeah. But it's one of the craziest scripts ever. That's why I love it so much.
Bit. All right. Have you got a favourite movie tagline, David?
I've got a bit of an obvious one, I've got to say. I like the tagline from John Carpenter's The Thing.
Ooh.
Which is, man is the warmest place to hide.
Ooh, that's really good.
That is good.
That's a good one.
Yeah. I don't know if it's my favourite, but one that has always stayed with me from the Sean Penn, Christopher Walken dream team pairing back in the 80s, At Close Range. Christopher Walken is the bad guy, the criminal, who returns to the family he's left behind. And there's the kind of hero-worshipping son who gets involved in one of his schemes. Anyway, and then played by Sean Penn, a young Sean Penn. Mm-hmm. And the movie is Like Father, Like Son, Like Hell.
Whoa.
Hey, speaking of fathers and sons, that's very much a theme dear to Noah Baumbach's heart, as he has proved once again with the release of his latest film, The Meyerowitz Stories, brackets New and Selected, which is up next. Noah Baumbach's latest film, a sprawling portmanteau, if you will, portrait of a New York family and their rather troubled relationship with their father, who's played by Dustin Hoffman, a sort of gnomic sculptor whose career has never quite received the, or has never quite hit the heights that he felt that it should have. I mention Hoffman, but also involved in this film, Adam Sandler, Judd Hirsch, Ben Stiller, Adam Driver, Elizabeth Marvel, or Marvel, not sure which, and who else? Emma Thompson. Which is great, because watching this, I was thinking, it's just one kind of Hogwarts casting choice away from being a classic kind of Hannah and her sisters Woody Allen production, and bingo, there's Emma Thompson. And especially, there's Hoffman and Sandler together at last on the big screen.
It's what we were waiting for.
Absolutely. All right, this is a film with a parenthesis in its title, which I'm never happy about.
Oh, really?
It always sets my alarm bells ringing, and I don't know if my reaction to the film was coloured by that. Birdman, brackets, The Unexpected Virtue of Ignorance, was it? It just screams self-indulgence to me. Say film is called, and the rest of it, your film should do. You don't need to put little kind of frippy bits at the end.
Well, I think that those little bits at the end, the new and selected, do kind of signpost Noah Baumbach's, I guess, literary intentions a little bit. I mean, all his films do seem to... I mean, there is actually... I can't remember which one it is, but there's the J.D. Salinger book that is called... I think it's like Franny and Zoe, or one of the other ones that's got a similar kind of construction where it's the title and then the brackets in the end. And it does seem to be, like, you know, Salinger seems to be someone who he kind of digs quite heavily.
The man loves books.
And yeah, I mean, my take on the film is that it is very, like, it's a writer's film more than a director's film. It's got, like, thick, sparkly dialogue that I just feel slightly in awe of it, to the point where I don't necessarily think the film itself is, like, a masterpiece. Mm. But I think that, I actually do think it's the sort of film that I'm watching it thinking, would I enjoy this as much if I were just reading the script? Because, you know, it's just to sort of see all that incredible wordplay and all the kind of jokes that are within jokes and the repetitions and the callbacks. And it just seems like this kind of technical marvel.
Which chokes were these? The fact that he keeps repeating one line of his father's? For example, Sophie Monks Kaufman, who I esteem enormously in the Little White Lies review, talks about relentless pace of the dialogue, a daisy chain of comic vignettes. The tone never really varies, yet this is forgiven when hours after viewing you find yourself grinning, remembering standout hoots. Which she cites as an example, Maureen, where is the gourmet hummus?
That was very funny.
What's funny about that?
That was really funny.
I mean, it's...
Yeah, you see the context.
But, I mean, that's the thing. It's like, it's a joke, but it's not, you know, it wouldn't necessarily be written as a joke. It's
right.
It's a background detail. It's a colour thing. And it's so random.
Which
and,
is fine.
Yeah.
But if that's what the movie's kind of enormous humour that a lot of the reviews talk about is resting on, then I'm perplexed.
Yeah. It's like all of Baumbach's movies. It's more like, it's not like a... romp. It's not like a comedy.
No, and I wasn't expecting it to be.
Yeah, but but it's just people being themselves and being, you know, a bit weird and that. Although I do think this is not his best. Like I don't think all the, you know, the dialogue, I don't think it lends as often as I wish it did.
I would say that in his kind of later movies like this, and he did a film a couple of years ago called While We're Young, he's kind of moved more into sort of satirical. I mean, it's all about kind of the idea of families and like pretension and, you know, artists and relationships, things like that.
It's maybe a bit less sentimental than it used to be.
Yeah. No, I mean, if you know, we'll talk about Squid and Whale later. But
It's fascinating because the inclusion of that 2005 film, so from 12 years ago, gives us a chance really to measure just how far he's come as a director, and literally inches, judging by this film. So when it's almost exactly the same film, but longer. I didn't enjoy this film. I'm not saying there aren't things that I didn't like about this film. I mean, clearly, watching it's a well-made picture. There are some interesting editing choices. Watching the likes of Hoffman and Ben Stiller, who I think is very good in this.
Adam Sandler. I think Adam Sandler is incredible in this.
He's great.
Incredible in what way? I mean, incredible is a big word to use about a performance. What was incredible about Adam Sandler in this film?
I think Adam Sandler can be amazing when he's used in good movies, which are not his movies.
Amazing because you're not expecting him to be competent?
No. That would be mean. No, I think he has a real energy and he's really good at playing kind of really perplexed and like really anxious guys.
Okay.
He's really, really convincing and really touching at the same time. Or at the same time, you kind of want to punch him, but he's really great. That this and Punch Drunk Love, I think I think it's happening.
I think that Sandler is a real, like, one of the things I love about him, and even in like quite a few of his kind of quote unquote bad movies.
I've never managed to watch one of his films. Okay. I tried watching 50 First Dates. I had to stop.
No, that's the worst one.
People told me it was the best one.
Watch Big Daddy or Billy Madison is a classic. Anyway, but
maybe
I think he's such an effortless performer.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it feels very natural for him, and like, I think the thing I liked about this movie is I never once got and I mean, you know, you might be able to turn this on this comment on its head, but like, it never feels like he's trying. He's kind of slinked into this role and he's just doing it. And you almost don't feel like he's acting.
Yeah.
I think he was pretty great in this film.
Okay, so shock me further by telling me that you agree with all the reviews raving about Emma Thompson's performance, which is kind of sub-Professor Trelawney out of Hogwarts, a kind of dizzy, humorous alcoholic kind of...
I was less enamoured by that, to be honest.
Same.
That was the difference in that, where I think Sandler felt like very naturalistic, Emma Thompson felt very contrived, like a character, a type. You know, she's the drunk, you know... We need a kind of comic relief.
Yeah, I agree. I think maybe if there had been more of her in it, we would have gotten more of a sense of her character and it would have made more sense.
Well, how about having a bit more of Jean, the daughter of the family, who's mysteriously almost written out of this film?
Like that's interesting, because she does have one really great monologue.
Yeah.
But and I think it's probably the highlight of the entire film. But for me, she seems like almost worthy of her own movie.
Right.
See, I would much rather hear more from her than Adam Sandler, who I thought was serviceable, but there was one scene in particular where he and Ben Stiller are having a moment on the lawn outside their father's show, in which I'm thinking, you had an amazing cast. Why on earth would you give this part to Adam Sandler? Because I didn't think he took it anywhere. My whole experience of this film was, there are some nice moments. I love the song that Sandler does with his daughter in the early part of the film, but I think I may have an issue with Noah Baumbach and this whole exploration, this slightly entitled offspring's complaint that the father didn't love them enough, which he explores in Squid and the Whale, and we'll come on to that later on. And he's added again here, and I don't know if this is too big a leap, but I know that Squid and the Whale was meant to be deeply autobiographical. Baumbach's parents were film critics, and it just seems interesting that he's using the medium of film as almost like a way of communicating with them enough that they just didn't give him enough attention. This is a long film. It's almost half as long again as Squid and the Whale, and I don't really see these characters developing in any particular way, which is fine. You can say they start there and they end in more or less the same place, but then you don't need to spend 2 hours doing it. Be a little bit more selective in which bits of new and select you actually choose to put on the screen.
I will concur with you there. I did think that it wore on a little, and like I almost felt like it kind of lacked a sort of a sense of levity, I think.
Yeah, and it lacked that sort of energy that is so specific to The Squid and the Whale, and that makes it so amazing, and it makes it, you know, an hour and 25 minutes long as well. It's a shame that he didn't... Yeah, it feels like the editing could have made it a lot better somehow, you know, more tight.
I think it's one of those things where you could probably cut just a little chunk of every scene.
Exactly.
At the same time, it's his desire to get all the jokes in. He's got so much material.
I'm mystified.
Yeah, you gotta.
Which jokes? So the father makes a joke about you should see the other dog.
The humor.
It's humor rather than jokes. I mean, it's you know, the hummus line is, I think we'll be quoting that to our kids in 20 years.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
I saw this actually on Netflix because it is it's not a Netflix production, but it's a film that's been acquired by Netflix. And there was some controversy about this at Cannes where you saw it actually on the big screen.
Yeah. Yeah, so, the big screen. I don't know. I think it was good to see on the big screen. At the same time, I would say that it's probably all right to watch on a small screen because it is a collective, like a collection of stories and all that. And it's not, yeah. But I don't know. I will always prefer the big screen. What do you think, David?
Well, I mean, I wonder if the differing reactions might be, because I saw it in a cinema as well.
Right.
So,
with a crowd.
And there
different.
Were, I mean, you know, there were people like, although I didn't really get much from the Emma Thompson character, there were people in the audience who were losing it over. You know, they were at, like, you know, hitting the chair in front with hilarity.
You're joking?
No, they were. It was really like, you know, not quite crying with laughter, but maybe increments off that. But you saw it on your own in the dark,
under the stairs in the cupboard,
bottle of scotch.
Yeah,
and
so I'm looking at her and I'm thinking this is a fairly thinly sketched, a very two-dimensional essay on the kind of slightly humorously drunk parent.
Yeah, I do agree.
The father as well is, and this is something we'll come back to on The Squid and the Whale, is a little bit of a caricature. I mean, fleshed out wonderfully by Dustin Hoffman.
Yeah, I think and, he does a good job.
Equally, you know, Adam Sandler. I felt that the writing was a little bit patchy on his character because he starts out being one thing and then the scene in the hospital, he becomes a very kind of daffy version of the earlier character, and then he kind of returns at the end. I'm not sure what I meant to take from that about who he really is.
Yeah,
but I think there are some nice little touches. I mean, this idea...
There are.
Definitely.
Like, one of his traits is he has this kind of gammy leg. And he sort of limps everywhere.
See, that got old for me quickly.
And I just really like this. You know, it feels like a very simple yet effective thing to do, to have this guy who is like in physical pain but chooses not to deal with it.
Mm.
And it says a lot, you know, it may be a little bit obvious, but it feels like, you know, it's one of a number of small little things like that that kind of build up his character rather than saying stuff.
Right, but he has a stock line. When people ask him about his link, he repeats a line. And the first two or three times, I felt that was effective. But I think he does it about six or seven times in the course of the film, much as Matthew, played by Ben Stiller, repeats his father's joke, air quotes, about you should see the other dog, which is fine, but it... I'm sorry. I'm obviously the exception here. And looking at the reviews, they've been massively positive. I personally didn't get on board with this film. Mm. Yeah, I would say anticipation for me, three, whatever. Slightly befuddled kind of 3 petering out to a 2 while watching it, and then probably a 2 after. But, you know, what do I know? Manuela, what numbers?
Yeah, Anticipation 3, because I don't really like late Bombad. So, yeah. Enjoyment 3 and Introspect 3, I think. It's a very medium film for me. But I do value a lot of the performances.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I'd probably go for the same. I mean, it's like, I did like it. I don't think it's like vintage Baumbach. I mean, it feels a little bit like he's kind of, you know, whipping the dead horse a bit. And, you know, I would hope that the next time out that we, you know, he chooses to do something very different. I mean, I think that kind of New York, Brooklyn, middle class, artsy family thing, is done now.
Oh, I think... I really doubt he will ever get away from that.
No, he won't. I mean, I say that,
and
but...
I think it's okay. I think there's a lot to say, and even if he told the same story again but better, like, it's, you know, all these stories have been told, you know, about dads being insufficiently present or whatever. I think it's all about the way you say it, you tell it, and he's told it really well in the past with The Squid and the Whale.
All right, well, I'll tell you what. Widely hailed as Baumbach's masterpiece, The Squid and the Whale is this week's film club.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
What do you think I should do about Sophie?
You'll make the right decision. I regret sometimes I wasn't more of a free agent when I was younger. There was a woman who approached me at a party at George Plimpton's after my first book. She was very sexy. I could have gone home with her.
Why didn't you?
I was with your mother.
Oh, right, of course. Well, you should have probably done it. It didn't stop her.
Yep, Squid and the Whale. It's a New York family. And a film that looks at the impact, particularly on the two sons, when the parents, one successful writer and university professor played by Jeff Daniels, and his wife, an up-and-coming writer played by Laura Linney, decide to separate. What did listeners make of this, Manuela?
So Pete Cox said, "Love this and Margot at the Wedding. Between them, they put me right off the man. However, Francesca totally won me back, and Mistress America rewards repeat viewings. So maybe I'm coming around to him, or maybe the world just needs as much Greta Gerwig as possible."
Quite possibly so.
Adriano Mirshu says, "Probably the best movie ever made about divorce and the impact it has on family." Yeah, I would agree with that.
Shall I read some of the Twitter?
Yeah.
Still in my top 10. I think it is the pace and the absurd of the whole entire story that keeps it fresh within my loving memory bag, and that's Metronome. Kevin Kisane. Daniels and Linney symbolise everything wrong about parenting, a fascinating insight into divorce and its effects. And Cuphead, I hate every character in it and I adore this film.
Right.
Yep.
Darren Richmond says no film has ever established what it's going to be about as succinctly as this one does with its opening line, "Mom and me versus you and dad." Matt Pringle, "The dad is up there with HAL 9000, The Child Catcher and Nurse Ratched as far as screen baddies go." All right then, not sure if he means that in a good way or not. Would you like to add anything onto that then, David?
I would just say that, yeah, I mean, it's interesting talking about this straight on the back of the Meyerowitz stories, which is, you know, I would say if I had any issues with that, it's quite long and lumbering. This film is like sharp and snappy and quick and, you know, fiery. And, you know, you have these really, like, between the sort of dialogue scenes, you have these really kind of loose montages that link the sequences together. Like there's this amazing bit in the middle where you see just a bunch of New York subway line names, and which, you know, very sort of amazing shorthand for like traveling across the city. I hadn't seen this one since I saw it in the cinema when it came out, so it was slightly nerve-wracking experience to sort of go back there after 10 years. But I had fond memories of it, and having seen so much other of his films, and actually I do find that like the second viewing of his films really helps. I
mean, really,
Francis Ha, the first time I saw it didn't do that much for me, then the second time I think it's a masterpiece. Similar with this, I'm just, you know, it's amazing. It's like there's just so much to it. It's 85 minutes,
81, yeah. I think, yeah,
and it just feels like every single shot, every single scene, every line of dialogue, every nuance, every character, every moment has something there to sort of look at and listen to and feel. And you know, one of the things that I just found myself hooting at, and again it's one of these callback things, is the patriarch played by Jeff Daniels, Bernard. The way he talks, and the terms he uses, his pretentious turns of phrase are just a joy. And he refers to things as the fillet of. Instead of saying the best, it's the fillet of. And it's,
does he say, have you read Kafka? He's one of my predecessors.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's amazing in this. And I totally agree with David. I think it's the key word for this movie is relentless. It never stops. And you don't want it to stop. And when it does stop, it stops so beautifully that it's totally fine that it stops. But it's, yeah, it has so much energy and so much, emotion, but not in a simplistic way. Like, it has very complex emotions. It's a lot of people, you know, thinking one way, going back to thinking a different way, and being really sad and mad about it, and then dealing with it. And then a lot of very intense emotions in such a short time. It's quite an experience.
One of the things I think that's great about Baumbach, and I think it's something that he's returned to many times, including in Meyerowitz stories, but mainly in Greenberg, I think, is this idea of, like, he sort of sets himself a challenge, is how can we empathize with these awful people?
Exactly.
What can we do, you know, how can we make these people who you just want to wring their necks, but actually you think, you know, I maybe see their point. I see.
Do you empathize with Bernard in this film? I think he's beyond the reach of empathy, isn't he?
I'm not sure he is, really. I think there's a sort of deep humanity there, and that he shows some really vulnerable bits to him as well.
Like, wait, Eisenberg?
No,
the father.
Bernard.
Jeff Daniel.
Yeah, totally.
I mean, you know, there is a kind of, the most tragic line is, remember that time I made burgers?
And it's the
most tragic, tragic thing, because he thinks that he's done so well, but he's actually in this kind of cocoon, and you don't hate him for it. And she starts laughing, and it's like, you know, you kind of get it. And he is, you know, he's realizing at that point, I wasn't a good father.
This is interesting, and I wasn't sure whether to say this or not, but this brings me on to my, can I call it an issue with this film? You say that he improves on second viewing. I really enjoyed this film when I saw it back in 2005. This time around, I still think it's a good film, and I think, as you say, it's tremendously tight, well-paced, and does really interesting things in terms of storyline and what it's exploring. But I was surprised at how, again, two-dimensional I think some of the characterization is, particularly Bernard the father. The line where he posits that he's been cleaning up and cooking, trying to save the marriage, and she points out that it was just once when she had pneumonia and she had to ask him to do it, and he did the burgers. It's a little bit sledgehammer heavy, that. There's not much nuance to that. He is delusional in his idea, his egotistical idea of who he is. But he's such a relentlessly terrible father. The competitive ping pong, the swearing, this parking business, which Baumbach goes back to in the Meyerowitz stories, as a kind of vehicle for exploring people's inability to I don't know, stay afloat among the pressures of life, or whatever it is he's looking to do there. I was surprised at how cartoonish the father is in this film, because it is, I mean, it's a film exploring the impact of divorce emotionally. And again, with this younger, is it Walt the younger of the two boys?
Frank.
It's Frank, okay. With Frank's way of kind of acting this out, you know, involving smearing his bodily fluids around the school, it seemed to me, again, that it's a little bit, you know, rather than going for any kind of insight into his emotions. Baumbach's actually just gone, oh, look, here's something that's going to shock you and make you think, whoa, we've been exposed to some emotion there. But actually exploring, letting us into what leads him to do something like that, we don't get that.
I think the nuance and the depth is all in the
performances.
Not just the performance, but also just the things they say. The fact that he says something like Kafka was one of my predecessors, and the fact that he says those things, you know, the competitive ping pong. But it's the attitude he has towards what he's doing that is so revealing. He's so in denial.
But it's not revealing.
He thinks he's doing this for the good of his children.
Well, I would say revealing would be something if there was a little hint within the way that he acts. He doesn't seem a believable character to me. It seems like I'm going to write a divorce story here, which is going to have an absolutely terrible father, a deeply sympathetic mother.
I think he's so...
Revealing would be if he was actually a decent man, but you begin to see through that between...
No, that's boring. That's not real. In real life, people are, you know...
There's no one in real life like this man.
They are. Yeah, they are so... You don't know my dad. There are people... He's not as bad. No, he's much better. It was his birthday yesterday, he's fine. But there are people, you know, he's just so... in his world, and he sees the world in one way, and he's so sure of himself. But we are on the outside. We see either from his wife's perspective or his kids, or just, you know, Baumbach's perspective. And we see him doing these things, like repeatedly being awful in a way that's so self-righteous. And
it's grotesque.
Like, yeah, it is grotesque. Yeah. But he's a guy who lives in Park Slope, for Christ's sake. Like, he's
the thing to
so
remember,
sure, and he's a writer.
The
and
thing
he's
to
an
also
author.
Remember, though, is like, you know, it is a movie, and you know, there has to be an element of, like, you know,
no, you can make whatever movie you want. I just don't, looking back, I was surprised at how much it didn't live up to my recollection of it as a well-observed study of the emotional impact of a divorce. What I instead saw, to put it in the simplest of terms possible, was a cartoonish representation of a father who's too obsessed with his own failed career to take any notice of those around him, a mother who was quite a long-suffering kind of rock of the family, and two kids who act out in the most kind of obvious of ways, but without any real insight into their emotions about it.
Should we start booing?
Yeah. Boo.
Well, no, tell me where I'm wrong.
I think the cartoon...
What do you learn about Frank, apart from the fact that he smears his semen on library books?
I don't know how old he is, but I think what makes... Cartoonish, I think, is a good word for this movie, because it is. But that's because the editing, the camera is constantly handheld, and, you know, it goes crazy. Like, from the start, you go crazy following this insane camera who goes... in really fast, but that's because it is cartoonish. It feels like a selected moments of life, and that's why it shows those crazy moments when the dad is going insane. And sometimes, you will see a tiny shot of vulnerability. Oh, here he's being vulnerable. Oh, here Jesse Eisenberg is like thinking twice about his dad and being like, maybe my dad is actually the worst.
So you saw God's Own Country recently, yeah?
Yes, I did.
Okay, that for me is a film which deserves the acclaim in terms of the writing, the characterization that was in that script, because at no point, or maybe early on, the son of the family is slightly caricatured in his attitude.
Into dodgy territory comparing movies.
No, they're the point I'm trying to make is that you can make whatever kind of movie you like, but I don't think this is as well observed as its reputation suggests. I think that it's a little bit... Actually, I think it's quite a lot two-dimensional in its treatment. And I think that he gets quite a long way out of the fact that technically he can mount a film quite well, and there's that whole kind of New York milieu which he's inheriting, which I think... And the kind of intellectual nature of the dialogue maybe makes people assume a little bit more of insight than there actually is in there.
I think that he's, you know, I think that what he's doing in this film is, I don't think he ever feels the need, and rightly so, to explain anything. I mean, like, what Frank does, why he does it, it's, you know, it's the reasons for it and why.
But it's easy to do that as a writer rather than give you something a little bit. No, it is.
He shouldn't tell you anything.
No, I'm not saying he should tell us anything.
You know?
Like, but what he's showing, again, he's using sledgehammer. It's all very heavy-handed. The father, how do we know that he's an egotist? Because he smashes his 9-year-old son at ping pong, because he constantly references his own work, and he talks about Kafka as his predecessor.
But he does it in such a backhand way.
There's no subtlety there at all. There's no realism there. Equally, the son, how do we know that the son is affected by the divorce? Because he smears his semen around the school's...
I mean, not just. And how do we know that not Walt, just. How do we know that Walt is affected by divorce? Because he starts quoting his dad and being like, oh, yeah.
No, but he was doing that before.
Like, he starts behaving exactly like his dad, and then he starts...
But he was doing that before.
Yeah, but he doubles down on that.
For me, it's four tropes.
Oh, no.
Four tropes.
No,
and it's an efficiently made film, and it's an interesting story, and they are so well played by the cast. I think Jeff Daniels is brilliant. I think the reason that you like and you think this character's believable is Jeff Daniels. It's nothing to do with Bambach's script.
I don't think that's fair.
Wow.
And I also think what makes it difficult...
I'm looking forward to the reader comments on this one.
Yeah,
please,
yeah.
Please get in touch. And
also...
The people who got in touch with me about Blade Runner.
Go crazy now.
Divert your attention to this abomination. Yeah.
I think what makes this film also, just one more thing, difficult maybe to see as subtle, is that it's a movie mostly about denial. It's about Jeff Daniels being in denial about who he is. It's about Laura Linney being in denial for years about how sad she was in this marriage. It's about Eisenberg's character being in denial about his dad being awful. And it's about Frank being in denial about how he's not a man who can drink beer and, like, you know, spread his semen around. So, yeah, that's why it's, like, cartoonish characters, because it's people who, like, bang against the wall. They keep going against that wall.
I would just suggest that you're
building cartoon versions of themselves.
Yeah,
maybe.
Because they're like, that's what I'm supposed to do, right? I'm like the writer. I'm like the father in this family. I'm supposed to be this arrogant guy because I am great. Because I am a great writer. I wrote those books like years ago, and no one comes to my conferences. But yeah, I'm a big shot. Mm. So yeah. And Laura Linney is kind of the only one who's kind of realizing what's happening. That's why she's getting a divorce, and that's why she's, you know, doing things. Although, yeah, at the same time, she's also having affairs with weird guys. But, yeah, I think that's why people are cartoonish. And that's why it's great.
All right, then.
And breathe.
And scene.
So,
that was our most heated film club yet. That was exciting.
Well, you don't just hate on The Squid and the Whale.
Well, I didn't say I hated on it. I just think that it's wildly
overrated.
Well, no, not overrated, but I think the praise for Bambach's script is misplaced, and I think he owes an enormous debt to the cast, which he's done well to assemble.
I saw in the notes just to say that it was supposed to be Bill Murray as the dad.
Well, it's
that
interesting. A couple of notes about this. Where is it?
Here.
Oh, yeah. Bill Murray was meant to be in the main role, which would have made this a very interesting take. Wes Anderson, actually, was Noah Baumbach's choice to direct, but Anderson himself convinced Baumbach to helm it because the film was so very personal to him. Mm. Uh-huh. Which kind of harks back to what I was saying before about people talking about their fathers who were... writers or artists and didn't pay them enough attention and who might maybe just happen to be film critics. Anyway, next week on Film Club, not sure what we've got in store. What have we got in store?
So next week in store, we have got... So the films we're going to be reviewing next week include Armando Iannucci's The Death of Stalin, which is his follow-up to In the Loop, which is a kind of political satire. And then we've also got a film called a new British film called I Am Not a Witch. And for Film Club, we're actually going to be looking at a film called Bulworth.
Ah,
are you familiar with said film?
I'm not sure that I am.
It's Warren Beatty's
the
film he did in, I think it was like 1998, and it's about a Republican senator who starts telling the truth.
Hmm.
And it's quite a nice little dovetail with The Death of Stalin.
Why do you think there are no more black leaders?
Some people think it's because they all got killed. But I think it has more to do with the decimation of the manufacturing base in the urban centers. Senator, an optimistic, energized population throws up optimistic, energized leaders. And when you shift manufacturing to the Sun Belt and the Third World, you destroy the blue-collar core of the black activist population. Some people would say the problem is purely cultural. The power of a media that's continually controlled by fewer and fewer people. Add to that monopoly of the media, a consumer culture that's based on self-gratification. Now, you're not likely to have a population that wants leadership that calls for self-sacrifice.
Excellent. Is that widely available?
Yeah, I think it's on, you can get it through Google, and I think it's on Netflix as well.
So right,
it's out there.
All right. Sean Hanrahan says that he doesn't feel we gave enough respect and attention to the passing of Jonathan Demme, who I think is wildly overrated. I'm kidding. Back off. No, I really love his films. He points out that his eclecticism would make Soderbergh's head spin as his career encompassed horror, screwball, thriller, social commentary, family drama, documentarian, nonpareil. And other words that I'm going to mispronounce, so I'm going to leave those. I would love to hear your opinion, says Sean, of Something Wild. That may be something we could do in future film clubs. Harking back to past film clubs, here's Sam Weatherall, just to finish off by saying, A Scanner Darkly. I loved this movie when I was 19, but I don't think it's aged well at all. It's interesting watching it in companion with Requiem for a Dream. They're both movies about drugs which manage to avoid addressing the issues of poverty or deprivation that usually accompany drug abuse. I thought there was plenty of that in...
I thought so.
Requiem for a Dream.
And Scanner Darkly, they live in a doss house.
Well, that's true as well. Yeah.
And Something Wild is really something.
Yes.
By the way, you really guys should.
Yeah. Melanie Griffiths, Ray Liotta's, and Jeff Daniels' best work, says Sean Hanrahan.
I don't know if Jeff Daniels' best work is The Squid and the Whale or Something Wild. So that's how good it is.
Nice. All right. We did talk about Jonathan Demme's passing.
We did. Yeah.
But obviously not enough.
As much depth.
Could we ever talk enough?
Didn't we do one of his films as a film club?
I think maybe we were going to.
No. Okay.
I don't know. Adam's put the whole list up on the comments section of the podcast page.
I'm also a big fan
page.
of the film Married to the Mob.
Yes. Michelle Pfeiffer. And, yeah,
and
good song.
It's on Netflix. I tried watching Ricky and the Flash, though. I couldn't get through. It's so bad. Dear.
Rachel Getting Married. Jonathan Demme. I really like that.
Love.
Great loading a dishwasher scene.
Oh, yeah. Incredible. Yeah. One of the greatest in cinema.
Possibly so.
Loading the dishwasher
so
scene?
Far, yeah.
We need a list of that.
Yeah.
Listicle time.
Yeah.
Okay. That is, in the meantime, it. So many thanks for being here, David, virus notwithstanding. And also you, Manuela.
No worries. Thanks
with your misguided attitudes and your lovely accent. if you'd like to get in touch, just a quick reminder that the email address is truthandmovies@tcolondon.com, Twitter @LWLies. And why don't you just go to the Little White Lies website and go to the podcast page and leave a comment there. We will be seeing you again next week, I hope. In the meantime, this has been a 7 Digital production.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.